Hello and welcome to Bitcoin with Jake. Today I'm speaking with Seb Bunny. Welcome, Seb.
Hey, how's it going? Honestly, it's a pleasure to be on here.
I'm very well, thank you. We're pretty far apart from each other, different time zones. I've just kind of walked the dog and ready to get going with my day, whereas yours is, you know, drawing to an end. So slightly different vibes, but thank you very much for joining me today. So this podcast is really, well, it's all about Bitcoin, first and foremost, which is pretty easy to conceptualize as a conversation, hopefully. What I'd love to do is just learn about yourself, Seb. So could you please give us an introduction to the projects you're involved in at the moment? And once we've run through that, to give us a good idea of what you spend your time doing today, we're going to have a dig around in what brought you to this point in time.
Oh, for sure. So we will probably get back to it, but long story short, where I'm at today is honestly like an absolute dream. And so I'm working with a handful of super, super inspirational people in the industry, such as Greg Foss, Daz B, he's on our Twitter, another guy called Jason, another guy called James Lavish, another guy called Max, who's Safe's audio video guy, and another lady called Dahlia. And together we're kind of working on a platform which is helping bring education about Bitcoin to kind of the mainstream, because we recognize, like, we really understand that there is an important need to help educate people about what is happening in the world. And we understand that when you start to understand what is happening in the world, naturally, Bitcoin is kind of like this orange light that kind of draws you in. And so we don't necessarily come at it from the Bitcoin magazine side of things, where we really want to push Bitcoin. We kind of educate people from the more of the macro scene, like, what are the issues we face in the economy? Why do we have wealth inequality? Why do we have rising inflation and massive debt? And then naturally that kind of leads you to Bitcoin. And so kind of that's the approach we're taking. And at the moment, we're looking at kind of expanding that into the school system and making more free educational resources online, because we realize the importance of easy, accessible material.
Wonderful. And I look forward to learning more about it. I confess I've had Daz was my first guest, and then I had James and Greg. We've recorded but not released yet. And I'm going to speak to also Jason and Dahlia, I think. So Daz has hooked me up with the whole Looking Glass team. The cool part being is that even though you're working together and collaborating on a project today with very clear goals, all of you come to it from a different perspective and a different journey. So it's equally as interesting to talk to each one of you, regardless of the fact you're working together at this point, as far as I see things. You didn't mention the name of the organization, but it's Looking Glass Education,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And it's one of those things, like, I think we all come from different backgrounds, whether it's just within the Looking Glass or even just the Bitcoin community in general. And everyone's approaching this from a different perspective. And it is just mind-blowing to be able to see how people can massage this kind of abstract idea of Bitcoin into this vision at which they see. Like, it's mm-hmm. such an incredible technology that is helping people all over the world fix so many different issues we face.
And that's actually a great segue, Seb, to let's talk about your lens on Bitcoin. And you weren't always interested in Bitcoin, I assume. What brought you to Bitcoin? Was there a particular moment in time, or what was it that you felt was and often people have a kind of a blended skill set of different things that all kind of came together to go, oh, actually this is what it all means. So perhaps just take us back in time a little bit and teach me about what it is you've done to bring you to today.
So my background, I've always been like, the outdoors is kind of like my life. I spend a lot of time in the mountains and a lot of time kind of contemplating and thinking. And so as a job for a while, I was a mountain bike instructor. I would kind of coach mountain biking, and I have a passion for educating and teaching. And more specifically, I love trying to distill complex subjects down into their kind of their base foundations in their easiest, most simplest form. And so I ended up kind of going through the mountain bike industry, absolutely loved it, but I felt as if I was missing something. And now early on, if I jump back to kind of being a teenager, I felt lucky enough. Well, I'm lucky enough that my mom gave me a book on real estate when I was about 12 years old. And I just burnt through this book on real estate and found it absolutely fascinating. And so through mountain biking, I started saving up for my first property. And then I started investing in real estate. Then I ended up going down I wanted a slightly more active role, I got frustrated with real estate because it was just this long game. And so I went down a slightly more active role of kind of trading the futures market, the options market, which then eventually led me to value investing. And through value investing in kind of the equity space, through value investing, I was just like completely blown away. I was just like, man, there are these companies globally that they have so much value and they're so underpriced. And I wanted to find these companies. But as I started digging around, I was just like, these companies are freaking impossible to find. They're so hard to find. And then that started opening my eyes to a lot of the issues that we were facing in the economy. Like, why is the equity space so overvalued? Why is the space so overvalued? Why are bonds where they are right now? And this started to kind of, it got me kind of questioning, and it got me thinking about more of the macro space and how everything ties together. And I think from there, I started to realize that if we look at whether it's bonds, whether it's real estate, whether it is equities, and we look at their valuations, how we value these things, the main input, the main driver in these valuations is interest rates. So if you suppress interest rates, then you're going to get massive distortions in these prices. And so this was why everything is so overvalued. And so I was just like, well, why are people suppressing interest rates? And then you start to realize the issues with the currency. And I think this is what led me down the whole Bitcoin rabbit hole. And I didn't actually, to be 100% honest, I used to despise Bitcoin. I used to think it was this Ponzi. I used to think it was this kind of piece of crap digital coin that kind of held no value. And you can only invest in, as Warren Buffett would say, things with intrinsic value. Whereas now what I realize is that value is very much subjective, and it's in the eye of the beholder. And so I think it kind of brought me to Bitcoin during kind of the early pandemic, and around kind of March of 2020, I started to kind of read more about it, kind of watch a few documentaries on it, because I've always had an interest in it, but I thought it was a bit more of a Ponzi. And so this time I decided just like kind of open my mind, embrace it, and just kind of try to understand it. And from then, within, I think, 3 months, I quit my job and I just dedicated all my time to Bitcoin. And so that was a little bit of kind of connecting the dots. I apologize. But yeah, just kind of that's where it led me to here.
That's what this conversation is all about, is connecting the dots, Seb. Awesome. I love it. So just to dive in on a couple of those, talk to me a little bit about some of your early real estate investments and the highs and the lows of that learning process. And then equally, I'd love to understand just at a very high level, a simple explanation for people as to what value investing is and the type of company that you think is therefore underpriced.
For sure, 100%. So starting on the real estate side of things, I ended up going into it like there's obviously, just like investing in the financial markets, there are hundreds of different strategies. The strategy that I kind of fell into, just because I felt it aligned with the job that I was doing and the amount of time that I could dedicate, was more of a long-term rental kind of strategy. So what I would basically do is try and find properties that could cash flow positive from their rental income. So if I was to look at, say, my mortgage expenses, my strata fees, hydro, all of that, and then I look at my rental income, I want to make sure that my rental income covers all of my expenses, so I have a cash flow positive property. And that kind of got me thinking a lot more about, okay, well, how can I generate passive income? And it is through real estate that kind of really built out this passion for investing, because I realized, hey, like, I don't have to work for my money, because I recognize that I loved Mountain Bike Constructing, like absolutely loved it. I don't Mountain Bike Construct now just because over the years of teaching, it kind of destroyed my knees. But I absolutely loved Mountain Bike Constructing, but being a wage earner, we have to work for our money. So it doesn't matter if you're earning $20, $50, $100, $1,000 an hour. The only way to earn money is to be out there and working. And so I think what fascinated me with real estate, and then as I kind of went into value investing in the equity market, is that there was a way to make a passive income through investing your money, making your money work for itself. And so that kind of led me down into, I think what I got frustrated with, I think I mentioned with real estate, was that it was a very much like a long game. Like, unless I wanted to start flipping houses, unless I wanted to start renovating, which I just didn't have the time or the money to do, I wasn't going to be turning these big profit anytime soon. And I think that frustrated me. And so I decided to start looking into the equity space. And when I started looking into the equity space, initially I went into day trading. And what I noticed with day trading is I wasn't cut out for it. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. It was so stressful waking up and watching your portfolio fluctuate wildly and watching these positions move, like just the volatility on some of the positions that I would take, because I would predominantly short pretty shitty companies. And so I'd predominantly take the more of the, what's his name? The, I've completely forgot the guy's name. Anyway, the short seller, I predominantly looked at short selling small micro cap companies, but I just found that volatility was just insane. And they could easily, because of the liquidity side of things, there weren't many people playing in the space. The price of these things can move against you very quickly. Mm. And that frustrated me. And so then what I noticed is I started to push out my time horizon. So I went from day trading to swing trading, swing trading into more of like a 2 month to 6 month positions. And then from there, I went into value investing. And so going back to your question about value investing tends to be a longer term position where you're kind of looking at, companies that are undervalued on some form of metric. And so usually when you're looking at companies undervalued on some form of metric, most people approach it from a Warren Buffett style investment strategy. And so you're looking for things that tend to have proof of cash flow and they're positive cash flowing companies. And they look as if they've had a short-term event, which has collapsed their stock price, but by no means has impacted the quality of the business. And so like a perfect example would be a few years ago, I think this is about maybe 4 years ago, I invested in Southwest Airlines. At the time, they had had a little piece of engine flick off the wing, smash the window, and I think it had killed one of the ladies in the plane. And so that had just absolutely hammered Southwest's stock price. But at the time, if you actually understood Southwest, this was not necessarily, they could never have foreseen this, and it doesn't impact Southwest's business. And so it's one of those moments where you're seeing a massive decline in the stock price, but fundamentally the business has not been impacted. And so that's where I used to find value investing really fascinating, because you're finding these discrepancies in the market where emotions have taken a hold and people are selling out of fear and not selling out of rationality. So that's kind of how I view value investing. Hopefully that answers the question.
No, absolutely. And you touched on some terms I've become familiar with recently as well. I did a cryptocurrency investment course and the way this guy was teaching was, you know, day trading is where you should end up. Swing trading is maybe on the way there, but actually more of a long-term investment horizon is where, you know, beginner investors are best off spending their time. Because frankly, day trading is extremely difficult. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that that's where you started and you've ended up reversing. So it's almost like, you know, that lesson I was taught was proven brilliantly in a sense by your story.
Well, I think like just building on that for a second, I think the thing is no one strategy works for everyone. Mm-hmm. And I also think what I've realized over the years is that you can be handheld and shown a strategy from a successful person, but that still doesn't mean that you are going to be successful in that strategy. I find that investing, whether it is through real estate, whether it is through cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, whether it is through the equity market, is such a unique and personal journey. And it takes time to find a strategy which aligns with who you are as an individual. And I think that for me personally, I recognize that I'm very empathetic and I struggle when I'm seeing wild swings in my portfolio. I struggle when I have to manage a position within an hour, like entry and exit within an hour, watching that volatility and being able to stick to trading strategies. Whereas I find when I have a much broader time horizon and I can kind of just open up my my tolerances a little more, then it helps with, like, it aligns more with who I am as an individual. And this kind of goes back to, there's two types of trading and then there's everything in between. There's kind of systematic trading and then there's discretionary. And so on one end, systematic is, say, high frequency algorithmic trading. Like it has been written into code exactly what the trading strategy is going to do. So it's going to buy here and sell here, and it will never deviate. Then you're going to get discretionary trading, which is purely going off of, okay, I'm going to use my discretion here. I feel like because of X, Y, and Z, I'm going to take this position. And then you've got everything in between where you've got people with, they've got a rough structure, but they still use a little bit of discretion depending on the situations. And so I think that where you've got to find is what strategy aligns with you. Are you more of a discretionary person? You like to be able to make decisions in the moment based on the information you're given, or are you more of a systematic trader where you're researching, you're defining your strategy and you're sticking to it absolutely step by step, and you're never deviating.
Yeah, that's great advice, actually. It's often the kind of thing that people don't tell you as well, right? Mm-hmm. And that's probably, I guess, a lot of the inspiration for Looking Glass. You go, oh, well, actually, there's a whole load of things that you can learn about before you reach this conclusion. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that a little. Excuse me. So value investing, it didn't work. Well, you couldn't find these companies. And you're like, why can't I find these companies? So what do you think are the main reasons that you can't find value today?
So I would say when it comes to, so throughout history, you see there's these really, really successful traders. And this is a bit more of like a philosophical discussion here for a second. But if you look at, say, I tend to sometimes get a little bit of internet connection. Yeah, so sometimes you'll get these phenomenal traders. But the question is, are these traders phenomenal at what they do, or does their strategy align with the macro environment at which they're in? And so I think it's really important to define that, because when you look at, say, Warren Buffett has been investing in equities since around the 60s and 70s, probably around the 70s. Now, what has also coincided with his investing career is interest rates going from the early 70s, from 20% or so, high teens to 20%, down to the zero bound. So this decline in interest rates has it's basically put the equity market on full throttle. So we have seen equity prices over this time just on such an immense bull run. And yes, there have been pullbacks, and yes, there have been recessions during this period. But if you had just bought and held throughout this period from the 70s through to present day, you'd be extremely wealthy. And so that's where it comes to this whole question with Warren Buffett. Like, if we are about to go through a regime shift where we have seen an equity bull market because interest rates have gone from 15, 20% down to the zero bound, and now potentially interest rates are about to reverse or stay stagnant for a while, equities are no longer going to have this tailwind. So therefore, would Warren Buffett, if he was born today, be able to carry on his success? And you can never really truly answer that. But I think going back to the whole equity, you mentioned why are we struggling to find value right now? I think this is because we have seen equities decline. All of this capital has fled into equities. But now, as interest rates are the prime driver in valuations, if interest rates, instead of going down, start to reverse and start going up, then what happens is all of these big corporations, which suddenly were able to use this incoming capital and divert it towards productivity and growth, are now going to start having to direct this capital towards paying for expenses, capital expenditure, interest rates, interest payments on their loans, and all this kind of stuff. And so we're going to see growth start to slow in the economy, and prices are going to start collapsing. And so this is where I think that the issue is right now, is everything is incredibly overvalued because of the amount of capital in the economy and where interest rates are right now. And I don't think interest rates, like, just as a side note, I think a lot of people sometimes, because we're so used to the suppression of interest rates, they forget what interest rates really are. And all interest rates are, they're meant to be a metric for risk in the economy. So if you were to just let interest rates normalize and free flow to not control them, naturally, if there was more malinvestment and there was a lot of risk in the economy, interest rates would rise. And then naturally, it would wipe clean a lot of these poor companies that are being fiscally irresponsible, or people that are investing from a malinvestment standpoint. And then at the same time, when there's low risk in the economy, there's not many zombie companies or a lot of these fiscally irresponsible companies, interest rates would be much lower and it'd be a lot easier to borrow. And so interest rates naturally regulate the risk in the economy. Whereas now, because we can suppress interest rates, that's not the case. Like, we have seen since the 70s or 80s, we have gone from almost zero zombie companies to now 20% of companies in the publicly traded companies are zombie companies. And the zombie company is basically a company that it doesn't have enough income to be able to pay its interest expense, let alone be able to function normally as a company. And so, like, why should this company exist? It should never exist, but it exists because of cheap and easy capital, because of low interest rates. Sorry, I went on a little bit of a rant there.
No, that's brilliant. And just to really solidify that, so on a very high, simple level, why does a high interest rate suppress the price of an equity and vice versa? I.e., a low interest rate means the price goes up.
For sure. So naturally, when you have, so first off, So there's two ways you can look at it. You can look at it from a corporate standpoint, and then you can look at it from an economic, like the economy and the population. So we'll look at it from the population standpoint first. So when you have low interest rates, it becomes easy to borrow. When it becomes easy to borrow, people naturally take out loans to invest because the potential return, because the potential cost of borrowing is so low, you have a long runway to grow that money. And so a lot of people naturally are going to go take out all this money. Money is going to flood into the economy, and that's going to raise asset prices. This is why when the central bank suppresses interest rates or the central bank pumps money into the economy, we naturally see asset prices start to rise because there's a lot of liquidity in the economy. Now, that's from the population standpoint. But then from the corporate balance sheet standpoint, it kind of goes back to, I briefly highlighted it, as a company, if interest rates are low, then they can borrow, which allows them to put more money into growth, which puts more money into capital expenditure in order to help build their business and expand. Whereas when interest rates are high, suddenly all of that money gets diverted towards paying down interest expense rather than growth and capital expenditure. And so suddenly you start to see, rather than a tailwind, you start to get a headwind, because a lot of your productive energy is going towards expenditure rather than growth, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And that's what makes it so fascinating, in a sense that an interest rate is, in a way, a metric to gauge the risk of an economy or a market. And it's set arbitrarily by humans. Oh, I'm going to decide what the interest rate is today. Well, how is that a free market? This is madness.
Right? 100%.
So hang on. So we've got, you know, wars all over the place. We've got supply chain issues. We've got government intervention in in economies like never before. So the risks are off the charts, basically. You know, who knows what's going to happen in the next 5 years? And if you've read things like The Fourth Turning, or equally Ray Dalio's recent books about the long-term debt cycles and the rise and fall of empires, you know that we're looking at a big shift in the way the world works in the next kind of decade. And who knows how that's going to play out. But the fact that that risk of this tectonic shift in generations and nation states is going to be identified and then fairly arbitrated by a group of people who set an interest rate, that doesn't make any sense, does it?
Like, to me, it doesn't. It's just like 100%.
Whoa. Okay. So this is all, it's all made up in some ways. And as investors, if you work that out, Warren Buffett 50 years ago, and you know that the interest rate's going only one way, and you load up on a bunch of equities, and, you know, and well done to him, obviously one of the most successful investors of all time. It's horses for courses, right? You've worked it out, and good on you. Well played. It's a fascinating time we're in at the moment, Seb, isn't it? Like, who knows where this is all going to go? Thank you for explaining all of that. So you mentioned March 2020 and you hated Bitcoin. Talk to me a bit about why you hated it.
So it's one of those things where, and I should kind of like preface what I mentioned earlier with about the whole Warren thing. I really value the knowledge that Warren Buffett has brought to the space, not the Bitcoin space, just the financial space in general. I think Warren is one of the most like thoughtful people, and he's willing to share his experiences and his knowledge. And I think that if you try and truly look at what he has to say, you can learn so much from it. And I think that the problem is right now is that I think we face in the economy, I think we face an issue with reputation. We see people that they make one wrong slip and they get canceled. But the reality is everyone makes mistakes, and everyone also has differing opinions. And so therefore, I think it's important to be able to recognize, hey, I don't agree with what this person says. When Warren Buffett says Bitcoin is rat poison squared, we don't necessarily have to agree with it. And that is completely fine. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that everything that he's also said prior to that is also crap. You know what I mean? So I just wanted to say, like, I think Warren is an amazing person. I disagree with some of his new values. And I think that he's incentivized to push a certain value, a certain perspective against Bitcoin. But anyway, back to your question. I think the first documentary that I watched on Bitcoin was back in 2013. And I thought it was fascinating. I think the technology is mind-blowing, but I didn't understand it back then. And I was very much of the impression, and this is kind of back from the Warren Buffett style teaching, is that things have to have intrinsic value. Whereas I think from diving down into the philosophical side of things, I realize now that intrinsic value is very subjective. And so just because something, say, has cash flow, or just because something provides value or service to society, that doesn't mean that it has intrinsic value, because what its service that it is providing to the economy or to me may differ from what someone else needs. And so a perfect example of this would be, if I had $1 million in my bank account right now, that's freaking phenomenal and it provides a lot of value to me. But if I lived on a remote desert island, I have no use for $1 million. It is going to do nothing to me. And so that's where value is purely subjective based on someone's experience. And I think that is where Bitcoin, a lot of people see it as this Ponzi scheme where it's only going to go up if people come into it. So they're looking at it purely from a speculative standpoint. What they don't see is all of the millions of people globally that are under overbearing governments that are either destroying their currency or preventing these people from opening bank accounts, from being able to save effectively through major taxation, whatever that may be. And what Bitcoin allows them to do is to be able to access a trustless and permissionless medium of exchange and store of value. So they can potentially now start to save, but they can also start to trade with one another. And so it's just blown my mind when you start to look at it from the perspective of not as the speculative asset, but you start to say, okay, stand back. How are people actually using this? What value is it providing to others? That's when I think it really starts to open your eyes. And now, to me, if it goes up in price, that is awesome. It's a bonus. But I think I quit my job not because of the monetary side of things. I quit my job because I realized that this is going to potentially repair the social fabric of society. And I think at the moment, the social fabric is pretty much torn apart.
I love that phrase, repairing the social fabric. It's very interesting how Bitcoin solves a lot of problems. And so I spent a long time working in digital products, and it's all about problem, solution. Then it's like market size and traction and all this other stuff. But if you're not solving a really acute problem for someone, they're probably not going to pay you to solve it. Mm-hmm. And so you can look at Bitcoin from the perspective of like my personal use case is really long-term store of value and managing an inheritance that I had. And so I've been trying to invest in assets for years to keep what I was given, basically. Mm-hmm. And inflation is killing me everywhere. And it's very hard to keep what you were given. But then actually there are people out there that literally don't have a bank account and they can't, how do they store any money? I mean, this is a huge fucking problem. And they come to Bitcoin from a very different perspective. And to your point, if you just dig a little under the surface and you start looking at user growth and you start looking at where people are using Bitcoin, that's the magic, right? So mostly in emerging economies, places like Nigeria, Vietnam have extraordinary growth rates in Bitcoin. And it's incredible to see. So you realize that this was actually a lot more interesting. And so you decided to quit your job. Talk to me a bit about how that felt. So what was it that really caught your attention so much? I mean, actions speak louder than words in some sense, but there was probably a morning you woke up and you thought, God, I've got to do something about this.
You know what? It was one of those things where during the pandemic, I suddenly saw that governments globally are just handing out money. Like it is destroying the currency. Canada went from one of the most, I think it was a AAA rated country that basically have one of the best credit ratings of any country in the world. And its debt to GDP was minimal. And it's basically gone to the second worst debt to GDP of any country with a debt to GDP of now 422%. And it's an interesting point actually, because Greg Foss talks about this a lot. And so if you haven't heard—
You're in Canada at the moment.
I'm in Canada. Yeah. And so Greg Foss talks about this a lot. And this is where, if you actually look at debt to GDP of 422%, if you assume that the average interest rate, and this is a conservative interest rate on all of that debt, is 3%, you're basically looking at, so 422% debt to GDP is basically GDP, if you're unfamiliar with, is the income, effectively the income of a country. So we now know that there's 4.2 times more debt than there is income coming in through the country. So if there's 4.2 times more debt than income, and the average interest rate on that is 3%. So 4.2 times by 3% gives us around 12.66%, I believe. That basically means that our GDP needs to grow by 12.66% just to be able to pay the interest on that debt. Now, the interesting thing is, if you look at Canada, going back for the last 100 years, its average GDP growth has been around 0.76%. So it is an absolute impossibility that we can pay down the interest on our debt, let alone start to pay the pay down our debt. And so this is where it really made me realize that if we're experiencing this much inflation and people just don't realize it yet, it doesn't serve me working for a job earning 26 bucks an hour or whatever it was that I was working for this man and bike company. And what serves me is trying to help educate people about the importance of effective stores of value and ways to be able to escape this inflation and this overbearing government and this manipulation of our currency. And I understood this for a while, but I piecing together takes a long time, piecing together all of these different pieces of the puzzle. And luckily through my investing through real estate and through a couple other investments, I'm in a position where I can just squeeze by not working. I slowly dig into my savings a little bit, but I feel as if at this time in my life, it's more important to educate than it is to work and spend 40 hours a week dedicating my time to some small corporate business. Because I think, as I kind of mentioned earlier, I think what is so important right now is that because our social fabric is tearing apart, I think it's so good that we have people that are trying to reach out and help. And what blows me away more than anything about Bitcoin is when you look at, say, the US dollar or the Canadian dollar or the Great British pound, these are centralized coercive currencies. They're being pushed on people by a small body or a small group of people. No one is stepping up and being like, I'm gonna dedicate my job to working for the US dollar. Whereas like Bitcoin being this like decentralized passion-based project, which is trying to fix the world, you've got millions of people globally, including your podcast, the other podcasts I've been on, people are just like dropping their jobs to be able to try and help educate people on this incredible technology. And this is where I think in the short run, you never know what's going to happen and you can't ever predict that. But in the long run, I think the truth will prevail. And I think people carry such passion with them that I never say anything's inevitable, but I feel very confident that change is going to happen.
And actually that very last statement you've made about you can never guarantee anything, but the level of confidence that people have in Bitcoin as they travel down the proverbial Bitcoin rabbit hole increases. Mm-hmm. This is a particularly interesting characteristic to it because I know, for example, I spent a long time in the startup space. You know, angel investing can be an incredibly lucrative business in that you put 100 grand, you know, maybe 10 people get together, put 100 grand into a startup, it becomes Uber. Your 100 grand turned into 137 million in under mm-hmm. a decade. Fucking mm-hmm. bang. You know, that's extraordinary investment success. And it's possible if you get it right. But the closer you get to a startup, the more you realize it's actually highly likely to fail because you can see the bigger problems. Mm-hmm. The closer you get to Bitcoin, yes, there are still problems that need to be solved and built on, but it's like it's only getting stronger over time. Mm-hmm. And people's conviction in it deepens and strengthens over time, mm-hmm. which is unlike other investments I've looked at. You know, the closer you get to real estate, you realize that, you know, it's very interest rate driven. The properties have maintenance issues. The tenants might want to leave, or maybe the government regulation changes and you can't get the tenants out and they're not paying you, or whatever the case might be. And it's, I don't know if your conviction necessarily grows the closer you get to it.
You bring up such an amazing point, and this is one of those pieces of the puzzle that made me realize the potential of Bitcoin, and this was a few years back, which was, if you look at say equities or real estate, as it goes up in price, it becomes more unfavorable because it starts to become overvalued, not the other way around. Whereas Bitcoin, as it goes up in price, it gains more adoption. As it gains more adoption, the chance of success increases. As it gains more success, there's a higher chance it's going to become legal tender here. It's going to be a world reserve currency asset here. It's going to be whatever over here. And so I think that what's fascinating is Bitcoin going up in price is the inverse, kind of as you mentioned, mm-hmm. to most other assets, which I think it's amazing.
Yeah, it's cool, isn't it? Wow. And you know, obviously here we are talking halfway around the world from each other, connecting over the subject, Bitcoin. It's an incredible time to be alive in a sense. I'm really so excited about what the next few years have in store. And that summarizes also another great part of this, that the optimism that this community shares is like nothing I've experienced before anywhere else, which is another reason why one kind of gets drawn in and goes, right, sack the day job, because frankly, the incentive has reduced, right? What's the point earning money that's disintegrating at a rate that you can't control and a government's quite willing to essentially lie to you about it? it's madness, right? And you go, this doesn't make sense. And you think about all of your friends and family you can potentially help to see this situation. You're kind of almost, you know, you're incentivized to start talking about what Bitcoin means.
I was going to mention as well, like, I think it's always fascinating. I'm curious to know, like, you're asking me these questions, but what do you think it was that brought you into Bitcoin? And what do you think it was that allowed you or gave you that inspiration and drive to start this podcast?
Yeah, love it. Turn the tables. Daz did this as well. So I don't want to tell too long a story, but I mentioned briefly that I had an inheritance that I had to manage. So my father sadly died when I was only 20 years old. He was a young man, 48, sadly. We sold a family property. I was the eldest son. I got some of that money. So from the age of 22, I was basically, okay, well, what the fuck do I do with this money? And that took me down the investment rabbit hole. Obviously, you can't just stick your money in a bank because you can't save in cash. The inflation rate, even back in, this was like 2011, you know, you 10 years later, your money's gone. Now, inflation rates today are a different ballgame to back then, but I have invested in using wealth managers. So in the, you know, public markets and equities and bonds and different commodities and other types of asset. I've invested in early stage equities and startups. I invested in some cryptocurrencies, in some real estate, and I guess have had I've had some success. I've had some failure. In fact, real estate's probably been my biggest headache. At this point in time, I'm just trying to exit from some London property investments I've made that actually I'm after 7 or 8 years, you know, arguably I've lost half the equity position I put in. Fucking nightmare. And you're so emotional about it and you beat yourself up about it. You got it wrong. But I was a 25-year-old man. I didn't know what I was doing per se. And I hedged my bets luckily. And therefore some other things have gone in the right direction. And, you know, the net position is I'm totally fine. But I luckily bought some Bitcoin in 2015. I sold most of it over 2016 and 2017 because I just frankly didn't understand what I'd bought, and I'd made some gains and I wanted to take my girlfriend, now wife, on holiday and, you know, all the rest of it. I was traveling South America and there's a whole load of funny stories about, went to Cuba and I checked my Bitcoin price on Coinbase and had my Coinbase impounded and I thought I couldn't get my Bitcoin back and, you know, all sorts of things. Bitcoin Cash, everyone thought the whole thing was going to fail. Anyway, long story short, suddenly you're sitting on, you know, the best investment you've made out of all of those other investments. Now, in hindsight, the asset was liquid the whole time. You don't have very little counterparty risk, right? You don't have tenants. You don't have any maintenance issues that might come up. And you don't have to trust a money manager to look after it for you. There's no 1% per year to give you financial advice. So just out of all of the experience I gained, working my nuts off basically on trying to keep this value for myself and my kids in the future, I just realized that Bitcoin is that's all you need. And so a lot of the experience I've gained in other investing, although very, very applicable, and the one I always like talking about is, especially in startups, they talk about investing in lines, not dots. So let's say I am a startup investor and I'm in Melbourne today and I go around and I might see 100 companies over a 6-month period at pitch events or introduced to me by my network and my deal flow, let's say 100 companies. They're all data points in time. The team is a certain size, the product's at a certain stage, the market you might analyze to be a certain size. A year later, those same 100 companies will have made some progress, hopefully. And so data point one is, you know, the first time you look at them, and data point two is the 12-month period later. And what you're really looking for is the fastest progress. Mm-hmm. And you then may place a bet on one of those companies and you're buying into this idea that they're going to make the fastest progress into the biggest market as quickly as possible. And that is what creates the hockey stick growth. And that's what creates, you know, breakout companies. Long story short, when I sat down and used that kind of investment lens and I looked at Bitcoin, I was like, well, this is the largest total addressable market I've ever looked at without a shadow of a doubt, like multi-trillion dollar market. Adoption growth is faster than the internet itself. the type of user coming to it have all sorts of different use cases and problems that they're having solved that are like drastic, huge problems. I cannot send value digitally from myself to my neighbor in like over 50% of countries in the world. Like, this is insane. And so I just fell completely in love with it. Not only did it solve my problem of store of value and therefore potentially, you know, I guess what I'm most passionate about is family wealth management is forever changed as a result of this asset. And you don't have to make the mistakes that I've made over the last 10 years in order to keep what your forefathers worked their fucking nuts off to get. And that's what really brings me to the table. And I'm hopefully, as a, you know, 33-year-old man, experienced a load of things that, you know, frankly, my father was so young. No one inherits money until much later in their life because their parents live till they're, I think Australia, the average age is 81 or something. Mm-hmm. You know, you're 50, 60 years old almost by the time that happens. It's completely different. So there's a generation of people that I think I can help that leverage off my experience, basically. There's a ton more to it than that, but that's kind of where I come to the table from.
No, I think that's fascinating. And I think you bring up such a really good point when it comes to the venture capital side of things. And that is, I think a lot of people, when they initially get into Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies, they look the other way away from Bitcoin, seeing it as kind of the old grandfather of the cryptocurrency space. Mm-hmm. And I think that the word cryptocurrencies is such a misnomer. I think that instead of calling it cryptocurrencies, in a sense, they're just digital assets. And they're kind of like an equity market. Correct. And I think the problem is what people don't realize is that it's an unregulated equity market. So you're effectively, as a venture capital investor, what you are doing is you are doing this immense due diligence to be able to determine which company is the best one to invest in. Now, the problem is people assume that just because something's trading on Coinbase or just because it's trading on Binance, that it's already gone through this due diligence, but that is not the case. And so the problem is 90% of these will fail. They're just startups looking for capital, trying to succeed. And most of them are only a year or two old. And the problem is for the average person, you haven't done the due diligence and you probably don't know, you don't even have access to enough of the knowledge to be able to make an informed decision on these things. And that's where it's just like, when you just step back and you realize that Bitcoin, like I'm not, and I should preface, I'm not, I'm all for human ingenuity. And I believe that there are going to be incredible technologies out of blockchain. But when you just step back as an average person, especially like a family person, wife with three kids, husband, whatever, and you're trying to get by, if you look at Bitcoin and you realize that currently it is a $600 billion asset and its total addressable market, if we look at gold, is 12 trillion. That's a 20 times increase in price. If we look at the bond market, we're looking at another 120 trillion to 200 trillion on top of that. The equity market, like we're looking at hundreds of X return over the next 20, 30 years, if it goes to where some of these people think that it's going to go, including myself. And so that's where it's just like, we can get greedy and try and get a 1,000x return out of some small, tiny little alternate coin. And yes, it may become big. I'm not saying that it won't, but it's so hard to predict because you're effectively a venture capital investor who's got a day job who doesn't have time to look at this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so that's where Bitcoin is. There's so much incredible knowledge out there. There is so much free education out there, including Looking Glass and including your podcast, where people can learn to understand this from the most incredible people and the most inspiring people. And it's simple to understand. The white paper is 8 pages or 9 pages long. And that is all, that's everything there is to know about Bitcoin in 9 pages in terms of its functionality. It's mind blowing.
And too many things to say, Seb. I'm loving this conversation. Thank you. I almost feel like Bitcoin and holding Bitcoin, the larger the percentage of my portfolio it becomes, the less stressed I am. Mm-hmm. Now, yes, there is short-term volatility in this thing, but actually being an investor is stressful, right? Doing your risk analysis, doing your due diligence, trying to work out like, is this going to work? Is this going to not? And the fact is you're trying to predict the future. Mm-hmm. And as you already said, like value is intrinsic value is subjective. Or beauty is in the eye of the beholder. How do you predict that other people are going to see value in the same thing you see value in, and therefore the value mm-hmm. of that asset increases? Or, you know, mm-hmm. how can you predict how central banks are going to behave over the next 10, 20 years? Like, we just don't know. And so by buying Bitcoin and increasing my exposure to it, you know, I know that I'm just, it's basically a savings technology. That's almost the simplest way I like to describe it to people. You don't need to worry about what you're investing into. Do you know what I mean? It's like, don't worry about what the price to earnings ratio is. Don't worry about what any of the other kind of like usual metrics you might use for investing. You're just buying a portion of 21 million that one day is going to be more valuable than what it is today. Like the deflationary nature of it. And so, yes, to your point, you could try and outmaneuver Bitcoin, try and outpace it with investments elsewhere, which I think is possible. Absolutely. I do see some people, venture capital investing into Bitcoin only companies, for example. There are some cryptocurrencies that will outpace them for a time. So if you're able to read the market and understand when to buy and when to sell, yeah, hell yeah. Like there are digital asset investors that are making an absolute killing shitting all over retail investors. Like this Luna blow-up that recently happened is mind-blowing when you look at the people on the term sheet that own shares in the business and invested huge sums like 18 months ago or whatever. These guys have made extraordinary gains, and then they've dumped it at the top of the market, and then bang, oh sorry guys, unregulated market, nothing you can do. So people are playing games that you don't need to play those games. You just got to buy some Bitcoin. And that's what I like about it.
Yeah, 100%. And you know what? Like the thing that I find really, really challenging right now, and this is what I'm trying to wrap my head around, is that back in, okay. So if you ever read, there's a fascinating guy called Luke Groman. Luke Groman does a lot of macro podcasts. Yeah. His stuff is phenomenal. And I would highly, highly recommend if any listeners are interested in the macro, read his books, Mr. X interviews. There's a volume one and a volume two. Now, one of the things he reveals in the Mr. X interviews is a while back, WikiLeaks leaked a bunch of Department of Defense documents. And in the Department of Defense documents, they basically acknowledged that they released the futures gold markets because the futures gold markets would suppress, one, they would create immense volatility in gold, but two, it was a way for them to suppress the price of gold. So it would deter people from investing in gold and instead force them back into equities or back into the US dollar or whatever it may be. Now, the interesting thing is we are facing a similar issue right now with Bitcoin. Bitcoin has got, especially in the financial realm, most companies cannot go and invest in Bitcoin directly. So whether it's through pension funds, hedge funds, whatever that may be, they have to invest through these structured products. So they're investing in through these futures ETFs. Now, the problem is these futures ETFs, and if you ever follow any of the on-chain analysts like Willy Woo, they're noticing that 90% of the price action right now is being dictated by futures rather than, and only 10% is by the actual spot price of Bitcoin. And so until we see the SEC kind of let the spot ETFs kind of go and allow them to kind of come into the market, I think we're going to see a lot of suppression in the price of Bitcoin, and we're seeing it, and it's frustrating because, but the way I view it is that it's a ball being held underwater. At some point, the more suppression you find, the deeper you hold that ball, when it slips and it goes up, it is going to absolutely rocket. And I think that the spot ETFs are inevitable, which is because we've got so many people lobbying and so many people, there's a lot of court cases going through pushing the SEC in order to release these spot ETFs. And I hope we see it this year or next. But I think that that's going to change the game a little bit. And I think we're going to potentially see a rally from that. But at the moment, I definitely think that the futures ETFs, whether intentional or not, and that's a bit more of a conspiracy theory, but whether intentional or not, I think that it's suppressing the price of Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, this. I can't say that I've done a huge amount of research on it compared to yourself. So thank you for sharing that. What is fairly obvious to me just from a fundamental level though, is that the more products that are created that are not Bitcoin itself, the more the price can essentially be suppressed in that, you know, as a bearer asset, if I don't own Bitcoin, someone else does. So if I want to buy it, I've got to buy it off someone. And that's obviously what drives the price action in a sense. If there is a whole lot of quasi Bitcoin investments out there, whether that's like MicroStrategy selling itself as an equity play on Bitcoin, or whether that's Bitcoin miners being like, you can buy Bitcoin infrastructure, or, you know, Grayscale or something like that. My fear would be is that the demand for Bitcoin filters into these alternatives that aren't actually the underlying asset itself. And therefore the price isn't doing what one would expect versus the demand that actually might be there. I guess mm-hmm. it goes both ways, and you know, at some stage that will change. And equally, you know, you only have to take Canada as an example. The governments are willing and able to freeze your bank account. Mm-hmm. They'll just do it. If they 100%. Feel like you're going to be in any way a problem for them, they'll do it. They'll mercilessly just shut your bank account. And that threat is ultimately what drives people to Bitcoin itself and the on-chain bearer asset. That's where the price gains are really going to come from long term, in my opinion, when you get more and more draconian central bank incentivized type behavior. My fear in the short term is that people's money is actually ending up in these kind of the outer regions of Bitcoin rather than the asset itself. I don't know if you've seen that or read about that.
Absolutely 100%. And I think that the problem is a lot of people, they go down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, they try and understand Bitcoin, they realize there is this incredible trustless, permissionless, decentralized product that if we were to ever see a major fiat collapse, which I believe is impending, I don't know when it's going to happen. It could happen in 5 years, could happen in 10 years. Nobody really knows. But when that happens, I think we're going to see the absolute decimation of our current financial markets. Now, people are going to rush to preserve their purchasing power. And so they're going to rush into things like gold, or initially they're going to rush into the dollar because the dollar has always been this safe haven kind of asset of sorts, which is going to preserve purchasing power for the short term. But if the government is going to be intervening with monetary policy, debasement of currency, they're going to quickly realize, hey, I don't want to be in the dollar. They're going to flood to things like gold. And when they flood into gold, they're going to realize, I can't transact in gold. I can't transact globally with gold. How am I ever going to be able to, as a country, how am I going to be able to ensure that trade, we're able to facilitate trade? And that's where I think Bitcoin steps in, when people start to realize, hey, Bitcoin really is this store of value digital gold that can be transacted permissionlessly, globally, in sub 10 minutes. And it is just mind blowing. But the interesting thing is, at the moment, people go down that rabbit hole, they realize this, and then they go and invest in these alternate products, which then you have none of the original benefits of Bitcoin. Mm. And I think what's interesting is I noticed, I posted up on a local Facebook page just saying, hey, I'd be interested to see if any local community members wanted to do a Bitcoin meetup. And lots of people were just saying, oh, you're investing in it as the price is just declining during this Ponzi. And it's a Ponzi and stuff. And I kind of responded and I said, I think what you don't understand is that when we have a macro kind of collapse of the market, like we're in right now, we're starting to see kind of a 20% decline in the market. If you just overlay Bitcoin with a lot of other assets, whether it's the S&P 500, whether it's the NASDAQ, you realize that at the moment, there is a beta of one. They're moving in sync with one another. There's a correlation. And that is because the people that are exiting Bitcoin right now are not exiting because they don't believe in Bitcoin. It is because those people are institutional investors that have invested in Bitcoin because they're trying to compete with their partners. They're not investing in Bitcoin because of the long-term prospects of Bitcoin. And so if you understand that, then you understand when Bitcoin goes down in price, it is not because people are fleeing because they realize the value proposition has failed. They're fleeing because these are the institutional people that at the moment, they're not investing because of the value proposition. They're looking at it purely from a gains perspective. And it's so like I think that is where-
speculators are fleeing, essentially.
Yeah, all the speculators are fleeing. And that's where stepping back and understanding, well, why are you invested in Bitcoin? Are you invested purely for the gains? If you are, then you can do what you want to do. But if you're invested in Bitcoin because you realize the value proposition of what it can do to this world, to all of these developing countries, to the people that don't speak English, then Bitcoin is here to stay. And Bitcoin has never been hacked. And so Bitcoin's value proposition has never been stronger.
Correct. And this, Seb, you know, we're touching up on it now, which is roughly where I like to finish up. But this draws us so brilliantly back to the premise for Looking Glass Education and understanding what is going on in the world. And Daz described it to me as grassroots financial education. And it's an excellent description for it, because what is an interest rate? What is the equity market? What is inflation? What is money? What is debt? All these things that they're not necessarily taught to us. You know, we have to go and learn them. And if you understand those subjects and you understand what might be going on in the world right now, it makes the value proposition for Bitcoin look, as you think, I think you mentioned it, like this orange, what did you call it? Like an orange sign or something at the start of our conversation.
Oh, an orange light, like a glowing light. Drawing you in.
And so just to close up, so I'd love to understand, so how did you meet the team at Looking Glass and how did that process just start initially?
So after I kind of left my job, and dedicated time to Bitcoin and understanding Bitcoin. That was in, it was actually, I left my job on Canada Day, which I think is, I can't even remember what the day that is. Is it like June 30th or something like that? Around there, May or June. Actually, yeah, being a Canadian citizen, people are going to be ashamed of that. But anyway, I left on Canada Day in around like June, give or take, in 2020. And I decided to focus all my energy on Bitcoin, just trying to understand it and try and get involved in the space and try and help out in any way that I could. And I was struggling to understand like, okay, where can I add value? And then I started to think a lot more about, okay, well, what is my skill set? Well, I'm a coach and I love teaching people mountain biking. I like distilling complex subjects down into their kind of their simplest form. And although my background, I really struggled with school and I actually dropped out of school when I was 14 years old. Although my background is not writing and I left English in my GCSEs in the UK when I was 12 years old and I'd never written anything since, I realized I was like, you know what? I want to try and distill these complex subjects of our macro space and how it leads to this thing, Bitcoin. I want to kind of distill that down into its simplest form for the average kind of Joe Blogs, the average wage earner. And so I wrote my first piece called When More Isn't Better, Inflation in the 21st Century. And I had no following because I've never really been a big fan of social media. And I just posted it on medium.com, like a long form blog article site. I posted it on medium.com. And at the bottom, I said, if you don't already follow these people or you found this article interesting, I would highly recommend following. And I put like Robert Breedlove, Preston Pish, Greg Foss, and a few others. And Greg Foss read the article and reached out to me and was just like, this is absolutely phenomenal. Like, is it okay if I share it? And I, at the time, I was just like starstruck, absolutely starstruck. Because I'd watched a lot of his content and I'd read his, he's got a piece out where he kind of explains Bitcoin to from a hedge fund perspective.
Yeah.
And so I ended up putting out this piece. Greg picked it up. He ended up introducing me to Bitcoin Magazine. Bitcoin Magazine ended up publishing it. And then over the next year, so from March of last year through to kind of the end of the year, I published 7 or 8 pieces through Bitcoin Magazine. And now my focus is like, I absolutely love Bitcoin and I think it's such an amazing technology. However, I am more of the mindset where we don't necessarily just need to educate people on Bitcoin. We need to educate people on financial literacy and how our economy works and how the issues that we're facing. Because if you understand that, you can understand the value proposition of Bitcoin. And that is where over time I ended up meeting Greg introduced me to Daz and another guy, James. And we started, initially it was the 4 of us, and we started kind of writing educational content. And we want to focus on this course. And so we've released, if you're interested, we released a course. It's a free course. And we kind of touch on what is money? Then we look at the evolution of money. How do we get to where we are today? And the pros and cons of different types of money. And then we look at debt, inflation, and the byproducts of debt and inflation. So like wealth inequality, consumption, environmental destruction. And then we go into, well, what are our options? And we go into equities, bonds, gold, Bitcoin, things like that. And then we kind of conclude it. And the goal is, and I mentioned this at the start, is that we think it is so important to educate people about the world and the issues we're facing right now. Because when they understand that, they start to understand Bitcoin. Because we also recognize that to the average person, Bitcoin is intimidating. The community is intimidating. And so if we just start pushing Bitcoin, people are going to walk the other way. And so we very much focus it from the financial educational side of things because we believe Bitcoin speaks for itself.
Wonderful. I love it. Well, very best of luck with the project. I'm a huge fan of just basically people's stories are always infinitely interesting. And you've shown a number of like steps in your life where you just had some passion for something and you followed it and you learned about it and now you're teaching other people about it, and it's just wonderful to hear. So thank you for everything you do, and I'm sure there'll be many people out there that get touched by the Looking Glass Education setup and are able to make some better decisions as a result. Awesome project, well done. Well, Seb, final question, where can people get in touch if they want to reach out?
Yeah, so if you're interested in the Looking Glass, just check out lookingglasseducation.com. You can also find us on Twitter at Looking Glass EDU. So the first part of education. You can also reach out to me personally on Twitter, which is just Seb Bunny. That's my Twitter handle. And it's one of those things like, you know what? I really value the Bitcoin community. And I think what you are doing, Jake, is absolutely phenomenal. I think that too often we jump into purely educational content and the podcast can get really serious. So it's interesting just to see like behind the curtains, like how did these people end up where they are today? Like, what is their background? And so I really, really value what you're bringing to the space. I think it is absolutely phenomenal. And I'm looking forward to listening to more talks because I think they're amazing.
Yeah, I love stories. I think that, mm-hmm. you know, people tell great stories. And if you can get them talking about what they're interested in, you know, they're very organic. People's personalities come through and you can just see that humans are so clever. Like the mm-hmm. people that just do, they do these incredible things and they don't tell anyone about them sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, well, let's let's bring that through. And, you know, you could throw an hour-long podcast at a friend or a family member that's just someone talking about how they got to where they got, which to my mind is an easier way of distilling the proposition rather than just saying, do this. It's that mm-hmm. kind of process of, you know, rather than teaching people what to do, it's like how to do something. Mm-hmm. And I find that leveraging other people's experience in life is a great way of deciding how to do something because you go, oh, yeah. Do you know what? That makes so much sense. I think I can probably take value from that as well. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Seb. I appreciate the kind words. Well, enjoy the rest of your evening. Thank you so much for spending some time with me and reach out if there's anything I can ever do to help. Thank you.
No, thanks a lot. I really, really appreciate it.
No problem. Take care.